Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself? I got an interesting email this week. He says, thank you for taking my
email. And hey, I'm Carol the Coach. I'm going to be talking to you about that email. It is from one of our listeners who cheated on his husband. Obviously, they must be in a gay relationship, and he wanted some advice as to what to do to make it right. So we're going to be talking about that. But in the meantime, I want to talk to you about tonight, our show, and just about sexual addiction in general. You know, you heard the promo, and it was Russell saying, I'm in all 48 states. And what I know to be true, and we all know that it's true, is that sex addiction is affordable because it can be free. It's anonymous because nobody ever has to know who's actually participating, and it's accessible. So here we have Russell who says, hey, I'm in all 48 states and I can go wherever I want and do whatever I want. That means it's anonymous, it's accessible, and I don't know if it's cost them any money or not. Sexual acts don't cost much money, that's for sure. I mean, I have clients that have spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on their sexual addiction, but I've also had clients that spend $40 a week. And so they are just as addicted as the men and women who spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so what do you need to do? That's the question. Had an interesting conversation with a client who said, you know, I am really doing great. I have a year's recovery. And I would say in the last 8 months, I have probably only clicked on images 20 times. Now, we're not talking pornography. We're talking NFL cheerleaders or Victoria's Secret models. And when I was talking to this client, it was within the realm of group. And the group guy said to him, hey, you know, you're playing with fire, you're going to get burnt. And I caught Russian roulette. And one of our group members said, hey, I caught playing chicken. Now, males especially, although I could relate to this because I played chicken too, you grew up testing the limits and the boundaries to see if you could get away with intimidating the next person, playing chicken. You know, I remember being in a swimming pool, being on the shoulders of somebody or having somebody on my shoulders, and you just kind of charged each other. And pretty soon, you were trying to push the person over. That was called playing chicken. My client talked about the fact that oftentimes you would do it with bicycles, motorcycles, cars. Well, in playing chicken, nobody wins. Because even if there's a winner, there's always a loser, and usually there are two losers. And with sexual addiction, you are a loser. If you click on that image, you have activated your brain. And if you have one day, 1 week, 1 month, 4 months, and you activate that brain, not only do you trigger the need for that image, but you really do set yourself up to start that whole neurocircuitry thing in your brain going again. So it's very, very dangerous to do it. And in addition to it being very, very dangerous, what inevitably happens is that, okay, you get off after 10 seconds, a minute, 10 minutes, a half hour, whatever, and you tell yourself, wow, I didn't do a deep dive into an all-night porn situation. That was not that bad. And that is the denial of sexual addiction. When you have a sexual addiction, any images are bad images. And to click on that link, you know, that's sitting there right with your NFL scores or the news or, you know, CNN or Yahoo, whatever, it sets you off into a spiral. And please know that we're talking about brain chemistry here. And brain chemistry plus addiction equals very bad news when you make the smallest wrong choice. So what do you want to call it, playing chicken? I had a client today that said, oh, that's like being walking the edge of a volcano around and around and around, and you don't think you'll fall in. One day you'll slip. I called it Russian roulette. Don't underestimate what that small click will do. It may not take you down today. It may not take you down tomorrow. But it will take you down. Because that is the insidiousness of sexual addiction. And so please remember that. You know, say to yourself, am I moving towards recovery or am I moving away from it? And if it is not working for you, if you're moving away from it, that's not a good choice. Okay, so I got this email, and I promised to talk to you about it. It's from a male, and he says, hey, I cheated on my husband, and now I don't know how to make amends. I've listened to your show, and I've tried making him feel special by giving him gifts and doing special things for him. But nothing seems to be working. I'm worried that I'm going to lose my marriage. How can I make amends, and how can I make him feel special again? Any help would be greatly appreciated. And we'll call him Joe. Well, Joe, yeah, you made a deadly mistake, and I would be interested in knowing the history of your indiscretion. You know, have you done this before? Has it happened to your partner before? Regardless, you're talking about using the five love languages. You said, I've tried making him feel special by giving him gifts. Well, gift giving is one of the five love languages. And you said, I've tried doing things for him, but it doesn't seem to be working. Well, that's acts of service. And for anybody who's listening, the other three love languages are words of affirmation, physical touch, and quality time. Now, he says nothing seems to be working. I would recommend that you get into marital counseling or partner counseling, because I'm telling you that there are other issues in your relationship that need to be fixed. Obviously, for you, it has to do with the fact that you went outside of the sacredness of your relationship. And that is such a blow to a partner. And I kind of can appreciate your partner's response. Why should he trust you? If he trusts you again, he may get hurt again. And so he's protecting himself. And yet he hasn't left, so that says to me, wow, there must be something positive in your relationship that he's still holding on to. And that's important, too. Here's what I know, and this is not meant to be bad news to you, Joe, but I work with people that get cheated upon, and a lot of times they leave the relationship. But I work with sex addicts who have monumentally and numerously cheated on their partners, and those people hang in there because those partners hang in there because they know that by the time they get to me, they really want to work. I wouldn't be doing the show unless, A, I had specialized treatment capabilities. And I obviously care about all you men and women, and I want to help you to get healthy. And so, as a result, anybody who works with a CSAT, a certified sexual addictions therapist, is going to get the right kind of help to maximize the relationship building that you need to do to rehabilitate and recover from your relationship. So, Joe, get into counseling. You know, make it right. Do whatever it takes to rebuild the relationship and certainly the trust. And that's what I got to tell you. I think you can do it as long as you really put forth the effort. And, of course, you need to stay in recovery. You need to stay faithful. You need to have support to do that. You need counseling with a specialist. And so does your partner. I wish you the best of luck. I appreciate your email. I know that, boy, it's scary to call the show. It's a lot easier to email me, so I would encourage anybody to email me at carolthecoach@AOL.com. Now, I got to tell you, my voice does not normally sound like this. I had a big family day at the lake, and I probably had 50 to 60 people come to the lake, and I was giving all the kids tube rights. And so I was screaming with them, you know, are you ready? Is this awesome? Everybody give me the thumbs up. I was really trying to make a difference in their lives. I think we need to do that for our kids. But as a result, by the end of the day, my voice was almost gone, and I never lose my voice. Didn't get better yesterday, and then after a full day of talking and a group today, I am spent. So please bear with me, because we have a really exciting show. We have Vicki Tidwell Palmer on, and I've had her on before. She just wrote an incredible book for partners called Moving Beyond Betrayal, The Five-Step Boundary Solution for Partners of Sex Addicts. And what Vicki does, she's got a couple of very unique services. One is she wrote this book. She knows how painful it can be to not have boundaries and to wonder, you know, how far do you go when you're in love with somebody who has impulse control problems, who has compulsivity, who has addiction. And so she wrote this book, as well as she has a course that I told her I want to take. It's for partners, and it teaches people how to, it teaches partners how to deal with the triggers in life and set better boundaries and actually restore and rehabilitate the relationship. Now, you know, we say in addiction that you didn't cause it. You can't control it, and you certainly can't cure it. So I'm not here to say that a partner can cure her husband or wife's sexual addiction. But what I really know about life in general is when we make right decisions, when we do the next right thing and honor our own sense of boundaries, that what ends up happening is that it makes a difference in all of our relationships. And simultaneously, it makes a big difference in our own self-esteem. So Vicki is going to be talking about, you know, what are boundaries and why do partners of sex addicts need boundaries and, you know, what are the key steps to boundary setting and, boy, how difficult it can be to maintain those boundaries when you get blindsided by something. Or in partner terminology, we call oftentimes what an addict does, it's called gaslighting. I'm sure if you're a partner out there and you've been with an addict and you know something's going on and the addict says, no, 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 you're crazy. Why would you think this way? You're just suspicious and blah, blah, blah. Gaslighting will make you feel crazy when in reality, the reality of what you know is occurring. So Vicki's got a lot of information about boundaries and the biggest mistakes the partners make. You know, what I know about this show is half of my audience is boundary people. They are partners that want more boundaries. Now, I talk to addicts about having boundaries too. So if you're an addict, stick with this show. You need to know what your partner's going to learn tonight, as well as this will probably help you in setting boundaries, whether it's with your mother, your father, your kids, your coworkers, your boss. Boundaries are always a healthy thing. And Vicki is the expert who can take this information to the next level. Like I said, her book is Moving Beyond Betrayal, the 5-Step Boundary Solution for Partners of Sex Addicts, and it just came out, and it is a great book. So, Vicki Tidwell Palmer, welcome to the show. Are you there? Well, it sounds like, are you there, Vicki? Sounds like we might have a little technical difficulty. Let me see here. I'm gonna put her on hold for a second and try again. Boundaries are so important, and Vicki is the expert in boundaries. So hopefully she will call back at 646-595-3284, and we'll get a better connection. I absolutely believe that she's got the 5 keys to making boundaries work. And I'm reading her book right now. I just got it last week. And I can't say enough about this book. I got mine in paperback. I love when people give formulas to make life successful. You know, I'm a coach. And I typically do that because I know how important it is to have a formula that you can enact. It's hard to remember what to do. So if it's an easy formula, it will make life happen. So, Vicki, welcome to the show. How are you?
Hi, Carol. I'm fine. How are you doing?
I am doing well. And, Vicki, I love the book. I love the concept. We need to learn more about boundaries. So, can you tell me a little bit about what got you involved in this work to begin with?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me on tonight, and I'm really looking forward to talking to you and your listeners about boundaries. So in terms of what got me started, are you thinking specifically about partners or boundaries or both?
Both, absolutely. I mean, this has been a special niche for you. You have really gravitated towards helping partners get healthy.
Yeah, I would have to say that what I have found is that partners, they just have such a need for so many things. I mean, self-care comes to mind right away. They need self-care. They need a lot of information. They need support. Oftentimes, they need very specific trauma treatment. They need community. They need to be with other people who are experiencing the same things that they're going through. And, of course, they need boundaries. So, I enjoy working with partners. One of the interesting things to me has been how many clinicians or therapists have really embraced this book, and I think it's because therapists are really hungry for more information about how to work with partners and help them with boundaries. And boundaries,
well, you know,
I always say, Vicki,
that it's the addict that carries the shame, but it's the partner that carries the pain. And they have the anxiety, they have the post-traumatic stress, they have the complex post-traumatic stress. They are the ones that they can't sleep at night. They're hypervigilant. And so to hear that you were going to write this book, I've been waiting for this to come out, because I know boundaries would help a partner to feel safe and stabilized in their own relationship.
Yes, absolutely. I like what you said about that the addict carries the shame and the partner carries the pain. That just, it's perfect. And that is absolutely the truth.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about writing this book. First of all, for anybody out there that may be listening for the first time ever, they may wonder, well, what is a boundary? So tell us a little bit about boundaries.
Well, you know, I call boundaries the ultimate self-care practice because I just think that they are. I think that they are the best way to practice self-care. And they help us to not only feel safe, that's what people usually associate with boundaries is feeling safe, but they also give us the space to be who we are and to express ourselves. And what I mean by that is that we do this by making choices about how close we want others to be to us, either physically, sexually, intellectually, meaning how much we share with somebody about what we're thinking or what we're feeling. And we also, in boundaries, we respect the rights of other people to choose the same, you know, how close they want to be to us, for example. And when people are practicing good boundaries, they're either protecting themselves from other people's unconscious, offensive or boundary violating behavior, or they're protecting other people from their own problematic behavior. So boundaries, they're just really essential. I mean, I often say that not having boundaries is kind of like trying to walk around without any skin. It's really painful and difficult. So they're so important, and they're especially important for partners.
Well, yeah, I would agree with that. And so many partners go, why am I the person that has to have the boundaries? Why don't they work harder on their own boundaries? So what would you tell a partner who says, why am I doing all the work here?
Well, I mean, to a certain degree, I have to agree that I think both people need to do their work. And but specific to the question about, well, why should I have to do it? The sad fact is that all of us are, in the end, we're responsible for our own self-care and our own safety. So, you know, one of the common things I hear about that one is if I tell a partner that I think it's really important for her to go have testing for STIs or sexually transmitted infections, I've had partners tell me, well, why should I have to do that? I'm not the one that did anything wrong. I'm not the one who acted out sexually. I haven't, you know, been unfaithful in my relationship or betrayed my partner. But the truth is that we're responsible for our own health and well-being. And I think that's probably the best answer to the question is that, yes, it's really great when other people do their work and other people learn how to set boundaries and do recovery behaviors and those kinds of things. But in the end, if we want to feel better, then that is really on our side of the street.
Well, and, you know, of course, when they go and they have the test, they're told to come back in 3 and 6 month intervals just to make sure there were no false negatives. And it is traumatizing to have to go and have a test when you have been faithful. You know, you wonder what's the doctor going to think, what's the nurse going to think. And if you divulge, well, I'm here because my husband or my wife cheated, it feels very personal. But that is really self-care, isn't it? You're really taking care of your own body and your own health.
Yeah, it is self-care. And the other thing, too, I think that's important for partners to know, and it depends on where partners are geographically, whether or not they can do this. But many times, especially if they live in a large city, I live in a large city, so it's easier for partners to go somewhere where, for example, they don't have to go to their own doctor. They can go to somewhere else and have more anonymous testing. But I agree. It can be very re-traumatizing and very triggering. And it's probably one of those events that's helpful to have a trusted person to be with you, to just be there with you, to support you.
Absolutely. And support is another very important self-care recovery tool, is it not? We need support.
Yes. Absolutely.
And yet, for whatever reason, STDs, herpes, AIDS, that is such a stigmatizing fear. And so you really do have to have somebody that you trust that isn't going to gossip about you, that you absolutely know is not going to judge you. And for many of the women that I work with, there's a part of them that doesn't want their friends to know because they don't want their friends to judge their partners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a huge issue with partners, and it's very, very isolating to be a partner of a sex addict. And partners, many partners that I know that I've worked with, they haven't told their best friend of 25 years, for example, or family members who they're very, very close to. So it's extremely isolating, and that is exactly what you said, the reason that there needs to be support, and then also community of other people who are experiencing the same thing, or maybe have, you know, they've traveled down the path a little bit further, and that can really help to guide and support.
Yes. Now, so we're talking about boundaries, and obviously you brought up the physicality involved in having a boundary and you know, saying, no, I won't sleep with you until you've been tested, and I need to make sure I'm safe, and we don't want to transmit anything back and forth, and the fear that goes along with that. Can you list some other boundaries that partners typically need to keep themselves safe and to keep their mental health safe?
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of them, and in the beginning, you know, the one you just named about sexual safety, that's an important one. And sometimes even from an emotional standpoint, partners may not want to, not necessarily being sexual, but they may not want to sleep in the same bed with the sex addict because they're just angry, or they really don't want to be that close to the sex addict or vulnerable in that way. There's also a lot of boundary setting that can occur around what I call collaborative transparency, which means that the partner may need to have and want to have access to email accounts or bank records, or even, you know, having an app on a phone that says where the sex addict is at any given time, and those kinds of things. Those are really typical boundaries that they usually get made in the form of a request. Those are other boundaries that are set early on. And also in terms of ending contact with affair partners, if that's the case, or having other kinds of essentially proof that the addict is doing what he says he's going to do, or that he has either, you know, completely eliminated or, you know, definitely minimized contact that he might have had with a former affair partner or acting out partner. And, of course, there's boundaries around devices in terms of computers and, you know, there's filters. And, I mean, there's all kinds of issues around computers and devices that come into play as well. And they're very specific usually to the situation. So for a lot of these boundaries, it's not a one-size-fits-all. It usually is something where you need to know what the addict's acting out behaviors are, and also what the needs of the partner are, because some partners have a need for a high level of, for example, the collaborative transparency that I talked about access to a lot of information, and other partners don't necessarily have that. And so I think it's important also to let the partner decide how much she wants to request and how much she doesn't have a need for that.
Well, that's a really good topic that you just brought up, and here's what I'm thinking. Because clearly, when I am working with a client, having those kind of boundaries is so helpful in establishing trust and proving to the client, just as in polygraphers and regular polygraph tests, it proves to the partner that their spouse is working. Now, it can get a little addictive, and I'm sure you've seen this to be true. It's like when 2 years, 3 years, 4 years have gone by, and the addict is doing good work, it's difficult for the partner to let go of some of the insurance that they've utilized in the past, whether that's a navigational system, whether that's getting to look at their email at any point. It's difficult for them to let go. And I don't even advocate letting go, but I advocate for, okay, now there's been enough time that I want you to get more settled in trusting the addict for longer periods of time. And that can be tough. What do you tell a partner who just doesn't feel they can let go of those safeguards?
Yeah, I mean, you made some good points about the timeline, too, because when there have been several years that have gone by, and especially if the addict has taken a beginning polygraph and several maintenance polygraphs, and they've all passed those, there does come a time where it does make sense for some of those boundaries and agreements and requests to shift and change a little bit. And that's a place usually where the couple has an opportunity, I think, to renegotiate what their prior agreements are. But if the partner is really got sort of a death grip on these boundaries where they don't want to, for example, you know, I've known of partners who wanted to have a polygraph every 3 months for multiple years in a row. And in my professional opinion, that's excessive. And so there really has to be some discussion with the partner around, okay, what are your thoughts about this? What is motivating you to do this? And of course, you know, we all know that there is a motivation around safety. And the reality is that often the partner can keep herself safe without resorting to that. And especially over a long period of time, when the addict has proven to be trustworthy. And I think this is also where the first step that I talk about in Moving Beyond Betrayal, the book that I just wrote, the first step around knowing your reality is so important, because I have seen partners over time where what they really start to trust more in is their own faith in their own reality, and trusting that even when they're getting information that may contradict that. And this becomes really powerful for partners where they really get more grounded in their own reality and they rely more on their own perceptions and their judgments and also their ability to act on those to keep them safe than they do on whether or not the addict is being truthful. And I'm not saying that the addict should not be truthful. That's not what I'm suggesting, but there does come a time with the partner's healing and growth where she does rely more on her own ability to trust herself. And I think that's hard in the beginning to kind of grasp for partners, but I'm wondering, too, if you've seen that over time.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, that's when I do two things usually. I obviously model my belief in that person's ability to use their head, their heart, and their gut. And I always say, you know, when you're assessing a situation, when you have a decision to make, you ask yourself, what do you think, how do you feel, and what do you know? And oftentimes, two of those are in conjunction. And I say, then go with that. You know, for so many of our partners, they've been so traumatized, and they're afraid to let go of the worst possible scenario because they don't want to get duped again. And yet, really,
exactly.
There's been a lot of time that says, hey, you two are kicking it. You're working on it. You're crushing recovery. Both of you are working hard. it's time to kind of let go of some of that white knuckling. And they usually do say, well, yeah, I do think that there has been enough time that's gone by and I am pretty slick now and I would recognize the signs and I haven't. So that's what they think. And then typically their emotions are going, don't trust, don't trust. He's going to hurt you again. You've been hurt. Well, okay, so that's the difference. But the gut says, you know, what I do know is that he has been going to meetings. He has been reading the big book. He is doing his meditation. He is seeing a CSAT. I have a knowing that he's still on the right path. He may not be perfect, but we are going in the right direction. And when they have that knowing and they have that those thoughts, that's two against one, and they really need to work at expanding some of those tools that absolutely are to them evidence that he's on the right road. So they go from the external reinforcement to the internal knowing.
And yes, and the internal knowing and also the trusting of themselves, that if they start to feel like there's something that's not quite right, that they will know what to do to take care of themselves and that they'll do that. Because many times in the past, I think for a lot of partners, they didn't do that or they didn't trust themselves. And there are a lot of reasons for that, that, for example, the deception and the lying and, you know, the gaslighting that we talk a lot about with partners. So it's not as if they didn't have some help, you know, with not totally trusting their reality. But I do think over time, that becomes easier for them.
Absolutely. And the other thing I say is, you know, let's break some of these tools down and just start using them less frequently. If they need every 3 months, I say, let's go 6 or 7 months and see how he does. One, you'll spend less money. Two, I ask them to come up with a consequence. If you find out that that extra time has contributed to him acting out, then you need to decide what you need to do to keep yourself safer. And,
yes, exactly.
You know, if somebody is acting out over and over and over again, I don't advocate that you stay with that person. I don't suggest a divorce, but I say you got to know what your limits are as a partner, as a spouse of an addict.
Right.
So then let me ask you, because obviously you have this five-step formula. You know, you talk about the five key steps of the boundary-setting process. And I've told everybody several times that your book is phenomenal. It's called Moving Beyond Betrayal, the Five-Step Boundary Solution for Partners of Sex Addicts. I'm talking with Vicki Tidwell Palmer. This book just came out. It's excellent. Can you give them a little bit of what that five-step process is? And you're welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Well, the first step actually is what you just mentioned before, which is about knowing and owning your reality. And it's pretty much the steps that you just talked about. It's, you know, what am I experiencing with my five senses, or what could I record with the video camera? The second question in the reality part is asking, what do I think about it? You know, what do I make up about that? What are my perceptions? And then the last one is about, you know, what are my emotions? So the first part is you've got to know your reality. The second step is about getting your needs met, because there, whenever there's a need for a boundary, there is some type of need or more than one need that's not being met. And this step, it's about identifying the needs that you have that aren't being met, and then also creating a really specific vision of the outcome you want. And then the third step of the five-step boundary solution is you identify your power center. And what I mean by power center is that, you know, when it comes to power, there are basically four options. We either have the power to create an outcome ourselves, we may need to ask for help, we may need to make a request, or we may be powerless. And if you don't know where the power lies in, you know, whatever the particular situation is, you can waste a lot of time trying to make something happen that's not in your control, or you can miss an opportunity to take action over something that you definitely could do. The fourth step in the five-step boundary solution is to create and implement your action plan. And this is one of my favorite steps. And it's based on how, whatever you identify identified in the prior steps and what your power center is. You either take action, you ask for help, you make a request. And, you know, there are some times when we're powerless to get what we need or to get any kind of outcome. And it may seem like that in that case there's nothing to do, but often being powerless requires that we do a fair amount of work in terms of, you know, coming to acceptance or even praying for the willingness to let go of a particular situation. And then the last and the final step of the five-step boundary solution is that you evaluate your results. And hopefully, you know, it's been successful, but there are times when boundary work is not successful or you realize that you need to go back and be clearer about what the agreement was. There's a lot of different things that can happen, including boundary violations. And so when that happens, oftentimes you basically start over with step one based on whatever that new data is. So it's a really nice framework to guide people through the boundary setting process because, you know, in the past we were really good at telling partners about how they needed to set boundaries, but there was really no instructions on, well, how do you do it or what are they? And that really was part of what inspired me to create this formula and write Moving Beyond Betrayal.
Absolutely. And, you know, it really gets dicey when you're working with, and I'll just stereotype right now, when you're working with a woman who maybe her husband is on the right road, but he still, he violates his own personal boundaries. You know, he may have been a serial cheater, and then all of a sudden she discovers after a year of not being on pornography, he's gone back to watching porn. And in some ways, this takes her back to that ultimate betrayal, and she ends up participating in behavior that she absolutely hates. She's throwing things at him. She's punching him. She's kicking him. She's telling her kids. She's emoting to the fullest because she's so betrayed. And when that kind of thing happens, although it's normal, it's not how she wants to show up in the world. And so that's when I say, you know, it may be that for you, a boundary is really taking more of a separation and getting more control over your behavior so that this does not send you to the moon. It you know, allows you to have your dignity, your integrity, and your self-respect because 5 years ago, you would have never kicked and punched him. Or 5 years ago, you would never have run into the kids' room and said, you know, your daddy's a flippin' liar. And, you know, but they're so traumatized, they just want to embarrass, humiliate, scare, punish, because they felt so betrayed. I mean, that betrayal is so terribly difficult. So for me, I work with, and of course these are extreme cases, but they happen. I work with them to set their own boundaries for self-care that is totally separate from the addict.
Yeah, that is a great point. And, you know, so far we've been talking more about relational boundaries or boundaries in relationships, but you are absolutely right that there are many times, and we do this all the time in life anyway because we're constantly setting boundaries with ourselves about how much we're going to eat or how much television we're going to watch and all kinds of things. But we do need to do this boundary setting process with ourselves. And you're right, especially with partners who struggle with rage. And I've worked with several partners who have, you know, been physically abusive to the addict or have, you know, acted out in other ways around rage. And they do need to, and the ones I've worked with eventually have set some boundaries on their own behavior. And it's very important because, you know, you just can't be relational when you're in a rage. And I think really often what it's covering is this very intense that the partner has about what's going to happen. And the rage, unfortunately, it feels a lot more powerful than fear or pain, for example. But you're absolutely right. I think, you know, we all have to do the boundary setting process with ourselves and our own behavior.
Oh, good point. Absolutely great point. Now, obviously, you've been working with partners for how many years?
I've been working with partners for 9 years.
Wow. And what do you believe are the biggest mistakes that partners make when setting their own personal boundaries?
Well, I think that they fall into two categories in terms of the biggest mistakes that partners make. And one is either they ask for too much. We talked a little bit about that in terms of, you know, the polygraphs or those kinds of things, or they ask for too little. And I think this is one of the reasons it's so important for partners to educate themselves in terms of addiction recovery and their rights as they're going through this whole process of discovery and disclosure. So when partners ask for too little, they typically don't make requests or they don't establish any meaningful boundaries. And sometimes they put up a kind of wall where they don't want to know anything about what the addict is doing for their growth or their recovery or their healing. And on the other side, when a partner asks for too much, she may become extremely controlling. She may be that partner we were just talking about who rages or even becomes abusive or violent. And both of these are extremes on the boundary continuum. So healthy boundaries are about being vulnerable in the relationship while at the same time feeling protected. But typically, I do think the biggest mistakes they make is just either not asking, you know, kind of being behind a wall or maybe being kind of passive about it, or being very over-controlling, demanding, telling the addict what he will or won't do as opposed to making requests and those kinds of things.
That absolutely makes sense because that is one of the key points, I think, for a partner. They never know, are they doing it too much or not enough? And so how do you help them to determine the right answer is for them?
You know, this is a time when I do a lot of education and also informing them about addiction recovery, about the nature of addiction, also about what a typical good, healthy recovery plan or a sex plan or an inner circle circle plan for a sex addict looks like. And one of the things I refer partners to, I refer addicts to it as well, but there is a part in Patrick Carnes' Facing the Shadow workbook that talks about what couples, and when I say the couple, I mean them together, but also individually, what they did in order to get long-term recovery and healing and growth. And that is a very clarifying piece of paper. I don't remember exactly where it is in Facing the Shadow, but it really outlines what people who were successful did. So I do a lot of education, and then I do a lot of, you know, exploring with the partner around what her needs are, because like I mentioned before, I don't want to sort of, you know, push the partner to make requests or do things that don't really fit for her, because that's not going to be successful. But I do want her to be very well informed, because oftentimes when they are, they do make more effective requests, because when you don't have the information, you just don't know what would be an appropriate request or what would really be a reasonable thing to expect a person in recovery to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're saying you don't know where that is in Facing the Shadows.
You know, I think I'm in my office and I'm going to see if I can find it, but it's in the very back. And I'll see if I can find it while we're on the phone and I'll tell you what page it's on.
Okay, let me ask you another question while you're looking.
Yeah, go ahead.
You indicate in your book that there are five really best-kept secrets to boundaries. And so I wondered if you could share one or two of them. We want people to go out and buy your book. And again, I am talking to Vicki Tidwell-Palmer, who wrote Moving Beyond Betrayal, Helping Partners of Sex Addicts and Survivors of Infidelity Identify, Create, and Maintain Effective Boundaries. So can you share with us one or two secrets from your newly released book on boundary setting?
Yeah, I think that probably my two favorite in terms of best kept secrets are that boundaries really give you great information about who other people are and how they're going to show up in relationships, how sort of, I use the term workable a lot, how workable they are. And very closely related to that one is that boundaries absolutely will help you figure out whether or not your relationship with another person is salvageable. And this one, I think, is very important for partners to know that if they learn how to you know, do this work and they're able to practice it to the best of their ability, they will absolutely find out if their relationship is salvageable. So those are my two favorite ones. I mean, there are others. The other thing, too, I think is important to mention is that I think they speed up, I know they speed up the process for the sex addict. I think that the recovery goes faster, and I mean, I would never tell a partner that's why they should practice boundaries, because that's really out of, you know, it's not on our side of the street what other people do, but I absolutely know that it will speed up the recovery process for the addict when a partner knows how to practice really effective boundaries. You know what, Carol, I found the page in Facing the Shadow. So it's chapter 9, at least of the edition that I have. It's the second edition, the one I have. It's on page 285. And it's chapter 9, What Makes for Long-Term Success. And it's got 9 points about what the two people did individually and as a couple for long-term recovery and success.
Well, let's go ahead and hear them again. And what Vicki is referencing is what I think is one of the best workbooks available, hands down, in the community of sex addiction, and that is Facing the Shadows, and it was written by Patrick Carnes, and it's the workbook that goes with Out of the Shadows. It has the first edition and the second edition, and you're in the second edition, right?
Yeah, this one is the second edition. It starts on page 285.
Okay, what are the 9 areas?
There's a paragraph for each one, but I'll just read you the first sentence of each one. Number one is they had a primary therapist. And when he says they, he's referring to the addict and the partner. Number two, they were in a therapy group. Number three, they went regularly to 12-step meetings. Number four, if other addictions were present, they were addressed as well. Number five, they worked to find clarity and resolution in their family of origin and childhood issues. Number six, their families were involved in early in therapy. Seven, if they were in a primary relationship, the couple went to a 12-step couples group such as Recovering Couples Anonymous. Eight, they developed a spiritual life. And nine, they actively worked to maintain regular exercise and good nutrition.
Wow, so they really worked on those recovery tools, as well as for many of the addicts, they know that third circle, the outside circle, healthy behaviors like exercising and fitness and nutrition and those kinds of things.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's interesting because I tell my clients, I say, if you daily practice 8 of these 10 recovery tools, it will work for you. And, of course, they go, well, what are the tools? And I say, you see a CSAT. Okay, you're not going to see them daily, but you're going to see them weekly. And you go to group therapy, and you go to 12-step meetings, and you do the recovery reading, and you do the 12-step reading, whether that's SA or SAA, and you have a sponsor, and you call people in the fellowship, and you practice healthy circle behaviors, and then, you know, you use those tools that you need. Obviously, in a relationship, for a partner, that may be the navigational system or covenant eyes or having access to all passwords. And for the addict, that may mean that you put covenant eyes on because you want to be honest and faithful. And you give your wife all the passcodes. And you put filters on your phone. And you contact the IT department at work and you tell them, I need to make sure I can't get onto Google.com. And you reach out there and you do what it takes to make it easier for you. And it sounds like that's what Patrick is advocating in Facing the Shadows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that chapter is a great resource. I've used it many times, and especially with, I probably use it more with addicts than I use it with partners, because I'm sure you've had this experience where, and the one that comes to my mind right away is I had an addict who came in who worked in the school system and told me that, you know, I guess he came in probably around, you know, late May or June, and he said, you know, he was going to work on this over the summer and just get it done in this whole sex addiction issue that he had. And, you know, a lot of sex addicts have that kind of mindset that, you know, they're going to work on it for a couple months and then they're going to cross it off their list. And I often just, you know, rather than get into a big argument about it, I just direct them to that chapter in Facing the Shadow, because it's very powerful and it's based on people who have already traveled the path and what they did. So I find it very helpful.
Oh, absolutely. So now, Vicki, as we begin to wrap up the show, I had said, certainly in the introduction as well as I was writing about what the show was going to be about tonight, I said that when partners use boundaries that work for them, it can really help the relationship. And I know you've been quoted as saying that it can help the restoration and rehabilitation of a partnership. And you just clearly said 5 minutes ago, you know, that when a partner does these things, it's not insurance that everything's going to work out, because if you got somebody who isn't really doing his work, nothing's going to help. But it does help a partner to know they did everything that they needed to for self-care and to ensure trust, and that they're working on themselves. Now, you have seen in your practice that when partners practice better boundaries, the relationship goes better, correct?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And
you have so many modalities to offer partners. Can you talk a little bit about your course that I've just been thrilled that you're offering, so that partners all over the world know about this course? I know it's not open right now, but it will be in the fall.
The one for moving beyond betrayal?
Yeah, and all about the triggers, too.
Yeah, actually, the Taming Triggers Solution is going on right now, and that one's offered a few times a year, but it's called Taming Triggers Solution. It's an online course, and I am also going to have a companion course for moving beyond betrayal for partners and also for clinicians. It will be two separate courses, but one will be for partners to walk them through the 5-step boundary solution and the other information in the book. And then also the one for clinicians and therapists will be more to help therapists to implement the 5-step boundary solution process in their practice. And I just have to tell you a funny story about what you were talking about a minute ago about partners and their boundaries. Is I saw a few weeks ago, I went to a community meeting where the local sex addiction therapist had asked to meet with some of the members of the Sex Addicts Anonymous community here in Houston, to have a discussion about how we could, you know, better meet the needs of the sex addicts in our community. And there was a man there that I've known for about 15 years, and his wife is a really dear friend of mine. And they've been in recovery for more than 2 decades. And he told me that he had just finished reading Moving Beyond Betrayal the day before. And he said, "Boy, I'm really glad my wife didn't have your book when we first got into recovery."
Oh, no.
I laugh, and I think that really sums it up, because he was aware that things would have been very different. And I joked with him, and I said, "Yeah, but it would have moved a lot faster."
Absolutely.
I truly believe that.
Absolutely. I love that at 100%. So,
yeah.
So more time, because here we are, we're talking to addicts and we're talking to partners, but also there are a fair amount of clinicians that also listen to the show. So one more time, that course for clinicians is called what, and how can they get a hold of it?
Well, the clinicians course is called Moving Beyond Betrayal Clinicians Course, and it's going to be available in the fall. And if people are interested in it, if you just go to my website, VickiTidwellPalmer.com, and you click on courses, it will take you to the page that has the information about all the courses I just mentioned, Taming Triggers, Moving Beyond Betrayal for Partners, and then also Moving Beyond Betrayal for Clinicians. And you can sign up there to get updates about the courses when they are open for registration. And the other thing I want to mention, too, while we're talking about that, is I'll be starting a confidential online forum for partners in August, and it will be an ongoing forum. So partners can join it for six-month increments, and it will have bi-monthly Q&A calls with me and also just a confidential private forum for partners to connect and to get support and also to get my feedback to them about whatever they're working on. So I'm really excited about that, too.
Absolutely, and we are, too. Nikki Tidwell-Palmer, I am so happy to have gotten you on the show. This book is so important. The courses are so important. You're doing great work out in the community and certainly out in the world. So you keep me posted on things that you're offering because I want my listeners, I want the clinicians, and I want everybody to know what you've got to offer because it's really making a difference. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Carol. And thank you for, you know, being so diligent with your show and your podcast. It's a huge help to the community, so I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Have a great week.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. So that was Vicki Tidwell-Palmer, and I'm telling you, you got to get her book. It will make a real difference in your life. And again, that book is called Moving Beyond Betrayal. And we're not right now. 5-Step Boundary Solution for Partners of Sex Addicts. And what it actually does is it helps you to identify, create, and maintain effective boundaries if you're a partner and you're making a difference in your own life by having integrity and setting boundaries that make you feel safe. I am so happy to have been with you tonight. For my addicts, I know you want the best for your partners. For my partners, it was good to be with you. And for clinicians, it's always a joy. Now, next week I'm on vacation, but get this, I'm going to be on the show. I am actually doing it live from my lake house, so I sure hope I get the proper connection. We're going to be talking with Jeanette Hutshaw, and she is going to be talking about her newest program in helping sex addicts. So we'll see you next week for more sex help with Carol the Coach. And as I say at the end of every show, you know, there will only be one of you at all times. I bet you could recite this now, couldn't you? I want you fearlessly to have the courage to be yourself. You're worth it. You're working on your life. You're creating the life you deserve. And it's up to you to make it a good day. See you next week.